Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with director Timothy Douglas, who's directing August Wilson's timeless play, Fences, which is going to be down at Ford's Theater from September 27th through October 27th. Timothy, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Absolutely. Good to be here.
Now, we spoke, I remember you came in studio alongside the original Wiz, who just won another Tony, by the way.
Isn't that wonderful?
When you guys were doing, you guys were doing King Hedley II, and now we're here doing another. I'm doing August Wilson. Before we dive into Fences itself, why don't you take a step back in case any of our listeners explain to them what exactly the Pittsburgh cycle was and where this actually fit in decade wise.
August Wilson, the great chronicler of African-American life, took upon himself to write a play about the African-American experience during the 20th century, one play for each decade in the 20th century. And Fences is his 1950s play, but was the second play that he actually wrote. He didn't write them in chronological order, but he did complete the cycle.
Gotcha. Yes, you're right. It kind of jumped around in decades, but eventually he got all the decades in there. And God, this is, especially after the movie came out, one of the more famous ones, at least in people's minds recently. Before we dive in, what was your take on that movie? I know Viola won the Oscar. She was awesome, you know. And Denzel directed himself in the role. What was your take on that compared to maybe, you know, past versions you'd seen?
Well, what was interesting about my experience is that I was in the process of directing a production of Fences when the movie was released.
Oh, yeah? Where?
So,
where?
At Pioneer Theater Company in Salt Lake City. And so I purposely sort of waited until my production was open before I saw it. And because the script was so fresh in my head, what I found most remarkable about the amazing job that Denzel and everyone did is how true they were to the theatrical script. I literally could recite along in order. And it's rare that a film adaptation doesn't take liberties, doesn't jump around, and doesn't cut a serious amount of dialogue. And I really appreciated just how much of August Wilson's text in order that the audience has got to hear.
No, I'm with you. It felt to me, other scripts would have adapted it and added subplots or even jumped around locations. No, it was stayed true. It felt almost like you were watching a nicely filmed version of a play. It rarely left that backyard or the house. I'm trying to think of, you know, a past example like Raisin in the Sun or something. It's hard to take that play and keep it in that setting for the movie version. But I think they did a great job. All right. Well, without further ado. You and I saw the movie, we've seen the play, we've read the play, all that stuff, but if our listeners haven't somehow living under a rock and missed it, remind them, you know, who Troy Maxson is, Rose, Son Corey, the whole thing, the basic premise here,
basic premise is an African-American family, you know, making their way in an America that doesn't fully accept the Black American family. And we focus on Troy, who is an iconic figure and holds his own against theater iconic roles like Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. And also the thing in this production in particular that is resonating more and more with me is just how the style and the depth of this character and this family reaches all the way back to Greek tragedy. It is no accident that the leading character's name is Troy. But you said basic, so let's go back. So it's a family in the late 1950s in Pittsburgh. Troy makes his way as a garbage collector, a trash collector, and is living with his wife of 18 years and his son Corey, who is just 17 and has the opportunity to play college football and, of course, get an education along with it. But because of Troy's very painful experience as a gifted baseball player, he mainly played in the Negro Leagues, but wasn't able to cross over into Major League Baseball because it just wasn't a possibility for him then. And it was at the time that Jackie Robinson did cross over, but Troy, of course, is past his prime age. And he carries a certain amount of resentment, but out of that resentment is a fierce desire to protect his son from experiencing the pain that he did, and discourages his son from a place of caring from pursuing this opportunity to play college football, and the family drama ensues around that. But it's about so much more than that.
Absolutely, and I love that you mentioned his failed baseball dreams and how he takes it out on Corey, who could have a future, but he's almost taken, it's like the sins of the father, he's trying to revisit it on the son, and it's
but
really not fair to Corey.
Absolutely, Corey has that opportunity, and we recognize it as a 21st century audience, but at the time, this is uncharted territory. You know, we don't know what college recruitment is. You know, it's,
right.
It's on the front edge, and again, and I feel always that I want to advocate for Troy. We don't necessarily have to like every choice that he makes, but it's really important for me that we understand him, and it is from this fierce protection of his son and avoiding the pain that he went through that he stands in his son's way, if you will.
Yeah, I'm also glad that you said that, because there are times where it feels, he feels almost like an anti-hero to Rose and Corey, but there's a lot of things he is heroic in a lot of ways, too. He's the protagonist of the piece. He's the main figure here. But I remember when you watched this story unfold, you admire his blue collar work. He goes to work every day and busts his butt and doesn't want Corey to give up the part-time gig at the AMP because that's like an honest day's labor, And so you can, I speak to that a little bit about how, even though he may be standing in Corey's way, you get it as a dad. I think that's the best sort of conflict is when you kind of can understand it, why he does that. He just wants his son to be a hard worker,
That's exactly it. But then the other thing about this play that's really amazing, and it's been very quiet. I've directed this play before, and I really didn't understand the profundity of the fact that the play opens with the discussion of Troy recounting that he's been called into a meeting from the higher-ups because he complained that there were only white drivers driving the trucks and only the black men are back collecting the trash. And he's been called into a meeting that he doesn't know what's going to happen. Troy, does that because he has a great sense of fairness. He doesn't know that he is actually stepping out into being a leader in the civil rights movement. So this play is really fascinating. At the same time that he's standing in his son's way, he is actually trendsetting and doesn't even know it.
That juxtaposition right there is great. He you're right. He's becoming involved while he's trying to block his son from it. It's fascinating. Take us into we talked about Troy and Corey, but dang, we got to talk about Rose. She's the backbone of this play.
That's it. And Rose really is so much more forward for me this time around. And I think it has to do. It's the first time I've directed this play since the explosion and recognition of the Me Too movement, and also since my father passed. And so for both of those reasons, it's Rose, it's the wife, it's the mother, who's really speaking to me the loudest. I'm not distracted by my father's voice. And now I can hear her, and with the amazing Erica Rose in the role opposite Craig Wallace's Troy, she really is a revelation that she can embody the pain wisdom, that's a hyphen, pain wisdom that so many women are experiencing now that voices are clearly being more and more heard. And as a result of that, I hear Rose through August Wilson in a way that I've never heard it before. And I've staged it in such a way to make sure the audience understands that as well. She is the rock, understands both sides. She can filter both her husband's and her son's both pains and aspirations, hold it, transmute it, and give it back to them. And that is part of her journey from beginning to end in this play.
And she gets the scene of the eruption and the emotional moment, man. I mean, it's great. Well, so we talked about the characters sort of as written on the page a little bit, but go into the actors as well. You mentioned that Erica Rose is playing her. What unique gifts does she bring to the role? Have you worked with her before? All that good stuff.
I've worked with Erica Rose once before on a production of Clybourne Park, ironically also at Pioneer Theatre Company in Salt Lake City. And that was several years ago, and I don't even know if she had her first child by then. But, being a mother and a mother of young children, she has a freshness and a rawness and and organized recklessness that she can bring to the role. And even though we're honoring the period of the late 1950s, there is something imminently contemporary about it. And she's just, you know, a gifted actor. I mean, she can't make a false move.
Of course. And of course we're bearing the lead, Mr. Craig Wallace himself, a good friend of the station. We've interviewed him a bunch. But you mentioned Willie Loman. He played Death of a Salesman at Ford's. He's taken over the role from Ed Giro of Ebenezer Scrooge and Christmas Carol every winter. So audiences will be familiar with him. I think he just did a Doll's House Part 2 at Roundhouse. Mm-hmm. Like, he's all over town. But what's so great for you about working with Craig, and how does he, you know, of all actors in town who could have taken the role, why'd you go with Craig? What, you know, what's so unique about that guy?
Well, Craig is impeccable with his craft and his process. He is insatiable in learning and understanding everything about the role, the world of the play, and in particular, all the motivations of the character, from the ones that are obvious to the ones that are deeply, deeply internal. He's the kind of actor that I don't really need to have a lot of discussion with. He's super smart. He really knows himself, and he makes very smart choices, and those are just a few reasons why DC audiences love him so much. But what is really profound about working with him on this play, and I think the audiences will agree, especially those who know his work, is that when I've worked with Craig, rarely, that's not true. Every time I do, I was about to say, the body of Craig's work that I've seen, I've certainly seen a lot more than I've gotten to direct him in, and it's not African or African-American specific, and it's wonderful. But with Fences, to have all of those attributes that he embodies combined with nothing short of our ancestors speaking through him as he is doing Troy. And the reason it had to be Craig Wallace is because of his classical theater chops, and as I already alluded, August is reaching all the way back to the Greeks in terms in the way of telling us how broad and how deep this role must be performed, but the actor cannot lose a hold of it. He must always be tethered to it, and Craig has that skill in spades and really just fully allows the legacy of our people to speak through him in this role. It is absolutely electrifying.
Awesome. And this could be off the record, but I'm actually probably most likely going to be directing a short film with Craig over the winter. Any advice, Mr. Timothy Douglas, on how how he takes direction? What should I do? How should I handle Craig?
This is probably a telling a tale out of school, but he is such a great collaborator, and I don't have to say a lot because he clearly understands so much, and he actually intuits a lot of what I want to say to him. But when I am giving him something, he listens like from the depth of his, you know, down to his toes. I know he's listening, but his facial expression, it's almost like all of my words and thoughts are being sucked into, no pun intended, a black hole. Like while he's listening, I cannot register how he's receiving anything. And that's okay, because when he then responds by going back to the work, when he responds to the note that I'm giving, it's fully there with mathematical exactness on top of the gifts that he brings. So I try not to panic, but the first few times I was like, oh, he hates what I'm saying. He doesn't understand. Oh, he hates it. But he's just taking it in and transmuting it, to use that word again, and then brings it back and gives you more than you even asked for. So don't panic with that look as you're giving him a note.
It's there. He's processing it. It's under the surface. Okay, yeah. I love it. All right, back to our regular scheduled interview. So we mentioned it a little earlier, when I was discussing the movie about, you know, how it's sort of all set there in that backyard, and of course in the house a little bit, you have the baseball dangling, from the tree as, you know, he's swinging his baseball bat as sort of the big prop that Troy Maxson uses. But in terms of how you stage this thing at Ford's, what are we working with visually? Is the baseball bat and you know, the tree and the ball, a significant prop that you guys use? Or just speak to a little bit of the blocking, you know, involving the set that you're working with.
You know, this is not a play that needs to be reinterpreted, at least yet. There's still so much to mine from the play, even though I've directed it several times before. There's always more. And so I don't yet need to veer. That said, I'm working with a wonderful scenic designer. Her name is Lauren Halpern. And we had, two challenges. One is, making sure that we are not fighting the interior of that theater, the historic theater, and that the presence of Abraham Lincoln's box is always present. There's no hiding it, nor was I interested in it. So it was important to create a world for fences that didn't fight it, that, invited a conversation. And so though we have the iconic house, the backyard, yes, the baseball is still hanging from the tree. But then, in the beyond, we created a backdrop that really opens the world. So there's space for the huge emotion and huge subjects that are being wrestled with on the stage, and also, space for the collective audience to be able to sit and feel and meditate on the enormity of this deeply personal family drama that everyone can relate to, no matter what the cultural background. So it was important that we didn't have such an ultra-realistic environment that sort of too much contained what will be flying around that room in the way of recognition and emotion. But in terms of iconic 1950s, Pittsburgh Hill District, the world of August Wilson, you will recognize it all, but will not be encumbered by it.
I'm just getting excited to see it. The more you talk about it, I think it's just one of my favorite plays. But speak a little, and you've been generous with your time, so we'll wrap it up here in a minute. But speak a little bit to the way it sort of wraps up itself. How there's this thing with Gabriel with his horn, and Gabriel's a unique character himself. But how he sort of shows up throughout, and in the end, there's a little bit of, he said he's going to try to open the gates of heaven for Troy. Correct me if I'm wrong, but did the movie end a little more spiritual than the play usually does, or how does that spirituality theme play in the actual, in your version?
You really want to give that away?
Oh, no, let's not. Well,
do it without
giving it away. Maybe talk to how that interwoven, but maybe don't say how it ends.
Well, let me answer it this way. So the wonderful Jefferson Russell is playing Gabriel, and what is really important for me to make sure that audiences get is just how intricately devoted the brothers are, that Troy and Gabriel are to each other. And the fact that Gabriel's way of processing the world has been altered because of a World War II injury that required him to have a metal plate put into his head, it was very important in this production for me to make sure that other than that, and yes, he's processing differently, but he actually is not diminished. What has actually increased is his devotion and care for his brother. And one of the things that he really cares about, that Gabriel cares about for Troy, is that Troy has his right place in heaven. This is one of the first things that Gabriel says when he first enters in the play, that his mission in life is to make sure that he's there for when it's Troy's time to play his horn so that St. Peter can hear him and open the gates for his brother's ascendance into heaven. Now, there are many ways to go at that, and I've seen many versions of it, where it can be easy to dismiss Gabriel as being crazy or kooky or not all there. I don't believe that. He's all there and more. He sees something, whether we can perceive it as quote-unquote normal humans or not, but he sees something that allows him to be completely embracing of his brother, warts and all. And, we hear certain traditional Christian-based religions that talks about God that way, that God only sees our perfection and not our sins and not our foibles. That's how Gabriel sees Troy. And that has to be clear at the end of the play, and that's all I'll say about that.
Well, you did a great job dancing around that. Well, before we wrap up, we'd be remiss if we don't mention, A, who's playing Corey, and B, who's playing Bono, because Bono and Troy have a great that's one of my favorite little, you know, buddy pairs in a lot of plays. They sit there and shoot the breeze, but dish on the co-stars that are playing those two guys.
Doug Brown, long veteran actor of DC Theater and elsewhere. I've done countless August Wilson plays for me. I've dragged him all across this country, and he's been in many of my productions, and he doesn't disappoint here. And I think this is the first time I'm directing him in this role. And he and Craig have a wonderful bond and chemistry together. And then Justin Weeks is playing Corey, and any, you know, serious theater goers in D.C. certainly knows who this young man is, whose career is very much on the rise. And he gives Corey such depth and dimension. And he made me realize something that I've never realized in all of my other productions, that, yes, Corey is seriously intimidated by his father, and that's the way it goes, and we've always done honest performances there. But what Justin reminded me of, without talking about it, he just brought it. Corey is 17 years old. He's a 17-year-old black boy growing up in Pittsburgh, and he has made it this long, having a lot to do with just his father's tough love, which makes him so strong. But he is his father's son, and here is a Corey that you will not see visibly cower to his father, which I've done before and I've seen in so many other productions, and it's not wrong. It totally works. But this is a lot more dangerous, that Troy has to face his younger self much earlier in the play than is traditionally done. And Justin brings that organically. It's nothing overbearing about it. He just is an innately strong and very smart young man and listens on stage like few actors I've ever worked with before.
Awesome. Well, you've been more than generous with your time, and you're talking lots about fathers and sons, and you mentioned something earlier in the interview that this was your first time directing this piece since, you know, you lost your own parent. I just want to give you I want to say sorry for your loss, but B, give you a moment. You said it was your father. Tell me a good story about him. What do you think of him? What makes you smile thinking about him?
Well, so the first story that came to mind is, you know, my father, also blue collar, not much means, really struggled to keep a roof over our heads as we were growing up, and the last thing he wanted for his son was to go into the theater. for several reasons he could articulate, but primarily he just didn't believe it was possible to make a living at it. And that was true from the time I started doing plays in school, starting in junior high, though he would come to see everything. But I had the good fortune of being accepted into Yale School of Drama, and I wasn't ready. I didn't feel ready. It was just too much for me. I felt like I needed to take some time before I wanted to take on something that huge. And when my father found out that I got into, you know, he knew nothing about Yale School of Drama. He didn't know what that meant, but he certainly understood Yale University. And he was like, "You're going." I don't want to go. I'm not ready. I can't choose. My father is why I'm here talking to you right now. The man who did not want me to have anything to do with the theater.
Isn't that funny? When push came to shove, you're going. You're going. You're like, "I want to stay at the A&P, Dad." No. Oh, that's great. Thanks for sharing me. That's generous of you sharing your personal memories like that. So, all right. Well, Timothy Douglas, it's always a pleasure. You know, you're a titan of the theater yourself, so it's always a pleasure talking to you. In closing, why should our listeners come on out? You know, maybe whether they've seen the play before, seen the movie, or have, you know, maybe never seen it. Why come out to your particular take?
Well, not because it's my particular take, but because the play is unapologetically American, and America right now with the deep divisions that we have on so many levels, and one of those levels we are looking at questions and conflicts surrounding race in America, particularly between blacks and whites, that we don't know what to do. We're afraid, we're angry. And coming to hear August Wilson's words performed by this cast allows a kind of a pause button. We can all just sit together and we can feel our frustration, our sense of conflict, the potential healing that is possible and only possible if we actually do sit with one another. And before we open our mouths and start talking, just sit and be and feel with each other. And when we get to that feeling place, it's a melter. It sort of becomes fluid and liquid. And then when we're sort of sitting in this pool of our just feeling it all, out of that, like the phoenix rising from the ashes, we can begin a meaningful conversation.
Awesome. Again, everybody, it is August Wilson's Fences at Ford's Theater from September 27th through October 27th. Timothy Douglas, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.